is a corrective, he thinks, is a meaningful rights-based argument for power sharing and resource sharing. In essence, what is needed is greater legislative acknowledgement of the landmark judgments that Canadian courts have already handed down, both as a prelude to and a consequence of the Constitution Act's recognition of Aboriginal and treaty rights. These decisions, beginning with the Supreme Court's Calder decision, affirm the existence of Aboriginal.
And I'm Daniel, and I'm the only other person here today.
Yes, usually we have a cast of others. We have Don or Rob, but, well, they're off, you know, doing those holiday things that have to get done this time of year. But fortunately, I'm here, and fortunately, Daniel's here.
Yes, we're very sad and lonely, so we have nothing else to do.
Yes, very sad. Well, Christmas, the season. But, you know, there's actually other holidays going on right now besides Christmas.
Like Hanukkah? Actually, I think Hanukkah's over, isn't it?
I don't know, actually. If you're on this here, you could tell us. But Well, there's also Kwanzaa.
I have no idea when Kwanzaa is. I'm sure it's a wonderful holiday for
people.
Probably
is a lot of fun. I hope to celebrate it someday. Mm-hmm. But, well, you know, speaking of the holidays and tradition, one of my favorite holiday traditions is eating cereal. But did you know that that tradition actually dates back 100,000 years?
Why do I doubt this?
Well, it turns out that a study at the University of Calgary has discovered that eating cereal dates back 100,000 years. It was previously thought to be only as old as 12,000 years old. And at a new archaeological site at near Lake Nasia in Mozambique, they uncovered starch grains on excavated plant grinders and scrapers. Presumably, this is the beginning of bringing in fruits and snacks, and my mic's not on.
That would explain why we couldn't hear you.
There we go. Well, technical difficulties at CITR. Well,
okay, well, in case you didn't hear much of that, Ethan was just talking for a while, and we realized his microphone wasn't working properly.
Well, see, that's why it's so important to have a fundraiser, which we did, and we raised lots of money, so thank you.
Anyways, back to cereal.
So right, so...
Are you saying that if I went back 100,000 years, I could still eat my Cheerios in the morning?
Maybe not Cheerios, but you could probably eat grain or starchy substances or possibly picked fruit or pieces of tree root. I mean, it's I guess we're speculating they use it as cereal. I mean, they probably put it in a bowl and ate it with some kind of spoon device. I mean, I guess that's the definition of cereal. We don't know how much milk they used, if any, but it's interesting. And I have a quote here from the study's author. The inclusion of cereals in our diet is considered an important step in human evolution because of the technical complexity and cultural manipulation that are required to turn grains into staples. So an interesting nutrition fact here on Radio Free Thinker. Well, speaking of nutrition, not really, actually, but speaking of water, almost water, on Titan, that's right, Saturn's moon, Titan, has recently been proved to contain liquid water. Well, not quite water, liquid methane, but it's almost water.
See, I don't really understand this. How is methane almost water?
Because it's liquid, and it's important for our understanding of the universe. NASA's Cassini spacecraft has discovered what scientists believe is the final piece of the puzzle for liquid water, or liquid methane. In a really spectacular photo, you should check it out, you can see sunlight glinting off the lakes on Titan's south pole. What this actually is sunlight reflecting off the fog. And since Titan is so cold, around 179 degrees Celsius, the only way fog can form is if it's in contact with liquid. So, and you couple this with sort of pictures that Cassini's already found of lakes, which we might have thought, oh, well, maybe they're frozen, or maybe they're just sort of, you know, tricks of the light. But no, this fog actually proves there is some liquid on Titan, which is pretty remarkable. I mean, we've been finding liquid throughout the solar system recently, like on the moon and on Mars, if you watch Doctor Who.
So what do all these findings of water everywhere mean for sort of the chance of life in other parts of the world? Does it kind of make it seem more possible that life could exist somewhere when we're finding water pretty much everywhere?
Well, I mean, it definitely raises the possibility. The interesting thing about Titan is that it's almost Earth size. It has a sophisticated weather system. It is possible you could find life. I mean, it's very cold. That being said, we do find life in very inhospitable environments on Earth. So, I mean, it's possible you might find a weird fish. I mean, you're probably not going to find ET. But it does open the door, I think. And I think it really makes a case for, you know, future exploration of the solar system is a lot more promising than what we might have thought before. But, well, segueing from what's going on in space to what's here on Earth, what's going on Earth, Daniel?
A little bit of good news about the latest flu pandemic, the H1N1 swine flu. It may actually have some long-term positive effects, or at least mid-term positive effects. That's because with viruses, there's something called viral replacement, where when a new pandemic-type flu comes in, it often pushes away the normal seasonal flus. And because those normal seasonal flus have been around for a long time, they have developed a resistance to the vaccines we use to fight them. Not a complete resistance. The vaccines are still good and helpful, and you should get them. But it does make them less effective. Like, the current H1N1 flu vaccine is something like 90% effective, whereas a seasonal flu vaccine is something closer to 70% effective. So if H1N1 does become sort of the dominant flu strain, that's going to mean that vaccines are much more effective. It also will mean that the elderly especially are going to have to be less worried about getting the flu because the H1N1 virus doesn't seem to target them as much as normal seasonal flus. So there's certainly some sort of midterm positives to the H1N1 virus.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be good in that sense. Of course, I think the cost will be offset by rolling out more vaccine for everyone else, as opposed to worrying about the elderly. Yeah, I mean, definitely there are some positives. And I think that we've mentioned before that in this case, the science that created the H1N1 vaccine and our sort of response was actually quite fast. We were able to get the genetic information on H1N1 I think the fastest ever, and get the vaccine out pretty, I mean, it could have come out a lot sooner, and it, hopefully next time it will.
Yeah, well, the government has even admitted that they screwed up on that one, and they should have had two companies working to provide them so they could get them out quicker, but...
I mean, we did dodge a bullet, though, I think, with H1N1. I mean, it could have been a lot worse. I was reading some blogs today about this, actually, and a lot of hospitals had a lot of deaths simply because they're not equipped to handle the infections that H1N1 causes. It makes it hard to breathe. And unless your hospital has sophisticated respiratory systems designed to, you know, literally like drill through your chest to get air to your lungs, you're in a lot of trouble. So, you know, it's you know, yeah, the H1N1 thing could have been worse, but there are some benefits, and hopefully it's a, you know, it'll be a kick in the pants to get science up to speed on this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I didn't want to sort of demean the true costs of the virus. Thousands of people have died around the world, and tens of thousands, if not 100,000, have been like severely affected by the virus as well. So this isn't too sort of
it's like the tiny silver lining in all of this is basically we've learned a valuable lesson, and we might actually benefit in the sense that, yeah, the seasonal flu might take a backseat for a year or two.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of viruses, the U.S. banking system.
Good segue.
Thank you. A recent study came out of the University of Michigan's Business School. And basically what they did is they looked at the recent TARP program in the U.S., which is the Toxic Asset Repurchase Program. Basically, when it was realized that the banks had bought all these completely useless toxic assets, the government stepped in with, I think, $700 billion to buy up all these assets from the bank so that they could get these horrible, worthless assets off of their sheet so they didn't all like cave under right away. Obviously, on past segments, I've argued that this is a bad idea.
Really?
That's beyond the point of this one. Basically, what they found is that banks with executives who sat on the Federal Reserve boards, which is the central bank of the U.S., they have boards all across all the states, or most of the states, that have, like, financial players. The banks who had their executives on those boards were 31% more likely to get TARP bailouts. And the banks with ties to finance committee members, that is the congressmen who serve on those committees, were 26% more likely. So this basically just goes to show you that it was much more politically motivated than it was any sort of reasonable sense of fixing the banking system. It was whoever had the best political ties would get the money. And it does really make you wonder sort of who's really benefiting from this. Is it really the economy as a whole, or is it these banks that basically did a whole bunch of stupid things?
Well, yes. More economics, which I know nothing about. Well, yeah, obviously there are some certain issues with that. And I think we'll be talking a bit more about politics for our next segment. We're going to be hearing from Don, and Don has a report on the Copenhagen segment. So why don't we go to that after this commercial break?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Fun!
While
Fun
cloaks itself in a plethora of disguises, its favorite mantle still remains
Fun. Fun
devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled. Yet
Fun
doesn't only destroy, it creates and molds as well. Let's examine closely then this dangerously evil creation, this new breed. But a word of caution, handle it with care, and don't drop your guard. This rapacious new breed prowls both alone and in packs, operating at any level, any time, anywhere, and with anybody. Who are they?
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. So why don't we go to Don, who's got a report on Copenhagen. Take it away, Don.
Hello, this is Don reporting from our virtual studio in Copenhagen, Denmark. I'm reporting on the climate change summit that's just finished up this Friday on the 18th. As people may or may not know, the Copenhagen Summit was intended to continue the work that was started in the Kyoto Protocols that were done in 1997. The aim, of course, was to reduce greenhouse gases, therefore avert any major climate change, and to come to some agreement as to how and who pays for these changes. One of the major issues that evolved out of it was the idea of climate reparations, where the third world, and more importantly, the suffering nations of climate change, such as the small islands of the Maldives, who will suffer disproportionately to climate change, feel that those nations that started the climate change, or were the highest contributors historically, Europe, North America, should pay reparations for the damage that they've done to the environment. Another major issue that came up is the difference between historical emissions versus current emissions. As people may or may not know, China is now the largest producing nation of greenhouse gases, surpassing the United States this year. Of course, emissions per capita or per person are significantly lower in China than they are in the United States, but as a nation of a whole, they produce more. The issue that arose out of this is they just surpassed the United States this year. And if you go back to the time when the Kyoto Protocols were being discussed, China's emissions were much, much, much lower, almost insignificant. So this basically means that the developing nations don't think that they should suffer as much as the developed nations because they're new to the game, that there's a disproportionate responsibility on the developed nations to try and fix the problem. So they think that, one, like with the climate reparations, the historically developed nations should pay for the changes in the technology that's going to be required to help the developing nations transform into more green, more lower CO2 producing countries. They also think that they should be given more room to expand so as they could enjoy the benefits that the Western world has already known. So these are two major issues that have come up. A third issue, which no one really saw coming, I don't think, was the way the negotiations themselves came out. In the end, the agreement that came out, which has flaws, but I'll talk about those a little later, was actually negotiated between four countries, the United States, India, China, Brazil, and South Africa, five countries. And beforehand, there was a leaked document from the Denmark government showing that the big nations, the developed nations, had already come to what they thought the results of the conference would be, even though ostensibly the Copenhagen summit was supposed to be very democratic. It was a UN extension. There were something like 190 some odd nations represented. All of them were supposed to have an equal say, and if there was disequal say, people would think that perhaps those who suffered the most would have a higher thing. But as it turns out, of course, it's a typical power play. The most powerful nations get to lay down the land. Now, I know some people say Brazil isn't such a big nation, but it's actually coming up there. It's just recently joined the G20 and has become a power to be. The point being, of course, is when the summit ended, you had, I think last I heard, about 20 nations that sort of signed on to this American-led, Obama-brokered agreement to agree about climate change, whereas the vast majority are either pondering or were left out of the loop or have to catch up. Now, of course, this agreement itself, the one, the Obama one, Obama swooped in at the last minute along with other nations and came up with this agreement. Now, of course, this agreement itself has obviously some flaws. The biggest flaws that people bring out is the fact that there's no binding restrictions on it, that really all they came up with was an agreement to agree. They say, we hope we'll reduce levels, and they actually gave some levels, but even those are contradictory. Most people, when they refer to the reductions, use the date of, I believe, 1990 levels as sort of a benchmark. So if we're going to reduce our CO2 productions by 5%, it's 5% based on 1990 levels. So that all usually means a much greater reduction in current levels. But one of the things that come out of the Copenhagen summit is the idea that these numbers will be taken from 2005 levels, which really makes a huge reduction. For example, the United States says that it's going to be reducing its level by 17%, but that's based on 2005 levels. When it's based on the original Kyoto Protocol numbers of 1990, it only works down to a 1.3% reduction. And of course, these numbers matter because in order to reduce the CO2, you need to have much more significant numbers. Most people are bandering out there the number of 350 parts per million, although most people say 250 is a number you would actually need to have no major reductions, but there's no way we can achieve that now. But the growing consensus out of the Copenhagen summit was closer to 450 or above, which means anywhere from temperature increases of 3 to 6 degrees, depending on where you are in the world. So there's a lot of things to be said for and against this summit, what was done, what wasn't done, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more in the future as left and right and middle and rich and poor, east and west, north and south, look at this, try and spin it in their own way, and obscure the facts, which of course is where the true skeptic tries to set in, separating hype from reality, facts from fiction. This is Don saying goodbye, eyes open, minds on.
Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more totally free at LiveMusicVancouver.com.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinkers. So thanks, Don, for that report. Just to our listeners, if you've noticed the sound quality is a bit poor, apologies, our mics haven't quite been on par today.
Yeah, for some reason they don't seem to be giving us the same clarity and volume as usual.
Yeah, well, hopefully that problem will go away forever. Speaking of things going away forever, the Copenhagen Conference. So for those of you who don't know, it was basically sort of a big gathering in Copenhagen, obviously, and designed to confront the issue of global warming. Pretty much across the board, people are saying, okay, this is happening, it's human-caused, let's solve the problem. Very few countries went in there with the mentality, well, you know, the jury's still out on global warming, except for maybe one person who I'll mention a bit later. The main point, and I think Don sort of explained this actually pretty perfectly well, is that all they did was agree to agree. Daniel, I mean, like,
for some countries like the U.S., though, that's all they really can do. Because the nature of the federal system in the U.S. is that President Obama and the executive branch cannot agree to something and then force it on the rest of the government. That rest of the government has to agree. So, and he can't really do very much more than that.
That's actually a really good point. I read about, I don't know, 4 or 5 different accounts of the Copenhagen conference, and I believe on the BBC they laid out about 10 reasons why it failed. That was, I think, number one. Basically, for all intents and purposes, Obama's hands were tied. He can't do anything without Congress. Mm-hmm. So he really can't take a leadership role in this. They talked about general politics as well. I mean, the different countries want obviously very different things. You know, China's going with different objectives. India's going with different objectives. I think one of the sort of big stumbling blocks as well was, for a lot of people, it hasn't quite hit home yet. And this is something that I read in another article, I believe on the New York Times, is that we're kind of missing a Pearl Harbor moment. No one's really witnessed the consequences yet.
I don't think there's, at least not in the near future, there's going to be any big Pearl Harbor.
Probably not, yeah. I mean, it's going to take maybe 20 years before we see one of those moments.
Mm-hmm. It's the problem with global warming and getting people, I think, to recognize and act against it, like really act against it, is that it is a very slow process. Yeah. And that it's because even if the trend is warmer, it's still sort of a cyclical thing through that. So you'll get years that go down in temperature than the one before, then you'll get like years that like go above but then like back down again. And yeah, to people who don't fully like realize what's going on here. It's almost easy for them to think that, oh, global warming isn't true. It's getting colder, but it's not.
Well, I mean, I guess you could also make the argument that there have been certain events. You know, Hurricane Katrina in the States was a big one. Australia just went through a very, very horrible drought. And there's been, in the past, massive heat waves that have struck Europe. One thing that I read, sort of that the sort of tipping point will be if the conveyor belt in the ocean shut down, mm-hmm. which will essentially plunge Europe into an ice age.
Yeah.
Might get some attention.
Yeah, that'll definitely change everything. And yeah. I think people might start listening. I think the argument would be that by that time it's too late to do much.
But. Well, see, that's the concern with me is I think we've reached the point where we're beyond fixing the issue. Now we're sort of containing the damage at this point. And it's sort of the agreement that they came to is basically sort of, well, we clearly can't stop polluting. Let's just try to, you know, limit things a little bit. Mm-hmm. Please. Because, as Don mentioned, there's no binding resolution in any of this.
Well, there's a bit of a problem in making binding resolutions on an international scale.
Yeah.
Is that binding resolutions require someone to, like, enforce them.
Exactly.
There's no international body that can enforce them. And quite frankly, thank God, there's no international body that has, like, the power to, like, compel nations, because that's probably, like, a one-way ticket to tyranny. But the best you can get out of this is a political agreement. But I think the real way to get change is not from summits like the Copenhagen one, or next year I think there's going to be one in Mexico that
there's already plans for like two or three more of these.
I don't think any like real good lasting agreements can come out of this. I think the only way we'll really ever act against this is on like a much smaller scale, with cities and provinces and states working towards it, and without worrying about whether other people are. And like, if you look at BC is sort of leading the way in Canada at fighting climate change with the carbon tax, which many people are against, but the carbon tax has much more sort of evidence behind it that it works than something like cap and trade.
I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. It's very difficult to get international bodies to agree to anything, really. And I think what Copenhagen kind of ended up becoming was, like what Don says, sort of like a backroom deal between the U.S., Brazil, China, and those other countries. And I think that, you know, especially for Canada, really was more about chastising nations that aren't pulling their weight. And unfortunately, that's Canada and also Russia and a few other countries. And I can't blame people for thinking that, because I'm going to read you a quote by Stephen Harper. This is what Harper has to say. The science continues to evolve. We've had some controversy recently because the science is not uniform. Not every scientist agrees on every detail, but we are guided by the preponderance of the evidence, and that is absolutely clear. Which is not a very strong statement of leadership on this issue.
Well, to give him some benefit of the doubt, there are many details of sort of the warming models that aren't perfectly agreed on. Like, for instance, the climate of the entire world is a very, very complex thing.
Yeah.
And so we can easily tell basic trends, and I think that's what he might be missing. But there is definitely disagreement on sort of what specifically is going to happen and what the effects that will, like, are we going to have some sort of catastrophic warming or something like that?
Well, I think that's all true, and I think that's a valid scientific debate. I think, though, that certain people are kind of using that debate within the community of science to basically kind of downplay the importance of the issue. And I think, you know, we've kind of seen this before with you know, talking about evolution or creationism, saying, oh, the jury's still out on evolution.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not. and I think that, you know, the scientific community has sort of reached a consensus that is, I think, pretty well established I've heard some pretty interesting arguments that it's good to have a minority that is not entirely won over. I think that's healthy for the science. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it is kind of depressing in a few ways that they didn't establish more than what they did, this kind of sort of wishy-washy agreement. And I think that as Canadians and as a skeptical podcast in Canada, I think that we should continue to promote skepticism on the part of our political leaders, but at the same time, enough scientific literacy to understand that a 90% consensus is actually pretty darn high.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Personally, I think that we should be working on sort of a municipal and provincial level more than sort of an international level to work towards this. Who cares what our neighbor's doing? If you truly care about global warming, you don't care. You don't care if Alberta's the biggest polluter in the world. You're gonna
care a little bit, but
you're gonna show them the proper way that you can have an economy that doesn't rely on harmful CO2 emissions.
Yeah.
Pumping dirty water everywhere like the oil sands do as well. And you can show them that there's sort of other ways to do it that way. I think there's way too much emphasis put on trying to get an international agreement. I think each different area should lead by example and not worry about what other countries are doing. And sort of the argument that their economy is going to collapse if they try and do that is ridiculous.
Hmm, interesting. Well, I'd be curious to hear what our listeners have to say if they're not too busy having turkey dinners and stuff like that. You can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com and let us know. Do you think that we need to approach this from a regional point of view, or would you like to see a binding international agreement? Or maybe you want a combination of both, which is probably the way it should go. Well, we're pretty much out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. Again, apologies for the sound quality. I hope you enjoyed the show nonetheless. And do we have any events to plug?
Not that I can think of. The next Skeptics in the Pub, maybe?
Yeah, remember, it's going to be a Skeptic Pub quiz, so please show up for that. And of course, we hope that you have a happy, safe, warm, and comfortable holiday season, whatever